Support for this Science Friday podcast comes from Google's Making and Science Initiative. They believe that passion for science and creative problem solving is key to addressing the challenges of today and tomorrow. Young scientists and makers can get started at g.co/makingscience.
Support for our podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Advanced genomic testing may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's been said many times by many experts, the quantum world is just plain weird. The idea that you can have two subatomic particles somehow entangled with each other, having some mysterious connection to each other, sounds like science fiction. But last Monday, China launched a satellite into space to test a possible practical application of that quantum weirdness, a so-called quantum satellite. As stated by China's state-run news agency, its two-year mission is designed to establish hack-proof quantum communications by transmitting uncrackable keys from space to the ground and provide insights into the strangest phenomenon in quantum physics, quantum entanglement. Here to tell us about that and other selected short subjects in science is Amy Nordstrom. She's an associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. Welcome back, Amy.
Hi, Ira. Thanks.
Quantum satellite communications. What does that even mean?
So this is a novel concept. This is the first satellite of its type to be launched. And the idea here is when we're talking about quantum, we're talking about a single particle. So in this case, it's a photon, a single photon, which is a particle of light. So the idea here with the satellite is on board the satellite, there's a laser and a crystal, and they can use this to split a photon in half. So you have a pair of photons. And those photons, you can then measure the properties of them relative to each other. And by doing this, you can use those properties and your knowledge of that in order to transmit a secure encryption key down to a ground station that could then be used to decrypt a message. So this is supposedly a hack-proof form of communications, which I think we would all really love to have.
So if that's one photon at a time, it's going to be kind of slow. This communication,
Yes, this is not the sort of communication that we would be using to transmit the things that we transmit on the internet right now. This would be a way to transmit a key that would keep certain messages highly secure. So we would perhaps first see it rolled out for military applications, for very highly secure government applications, perhaps for banks or financial firms. That's the sort of places that we could probably expect to see it used first.
So the magic here is that because you start out with one photon and split them in two, these two are then entangled. And whatever happens to one simultaneously happens to the other on the ground.
Well, or in this case, there's a nice way that you can basically use one as a reference to the other. So when you transmit a photon down to Earth from the satellite, you could keep that one on the satellite as a reference material. So if you receive the one on Earth, you know its properties relative to the one back on the satellite. And if anybody has tampered with that photon on the way, they might have altered those properties in such a way that you would be able to tell. It would be very obvious that it had been tampered with. And then you could know that that message was not one that you wanted to believe or trust.
So that supposedly is the crack proof method.
Exactly. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'm sure that other people will be trying this, right?
Absolutely. Singapore has plans for a quantum satellite. Canada has plans. There's been some other efforts here with GroundLinks as well.
There could be one up there that we don't even know about.
That's a whole other subject. It's true.
All right. Let's move on to the record awful flooding in Louisiana. And there's worry that that kind of flooding might become more common.
Right. So Louisiana has just been battered with floods. This weather that they've had over the last week, starting last Friday, has dropped 20 to 30 inches of rain on some areas. These are levels that we typically only see with tropical storms, tropical depressions. And the issue with this weather system was it was pulling up tropical moisture from below, and there was a low pressure system over Louisiana, and then it sort of got stuck there. It was very slow moving, so it continued to kind of dump rain on the area for quite a while. It could still take 2 to 4 weeks for the communities to recover and for the water tables to actually go down. But certainly these are the types of storms and the types of events that climate scientists have predicted happening more often and perhaps worsening with intensity and severity due to climate change.
Because this was called a 500-year flood, right?
So that is, yeah, there are areas where that's what it's being called. And the important thing to note with that is that terminology does not mean that it's going to occur only once in 500 years. That's the way that a lot of people think of it. Mm-hmm. But it actually means that in any given year, there's about a 1 in 500 chance that it could occur. And that's different because when you have a 1 in 500 chance, you know, scientists would expect that event to occur twice over a 1,000-year period. But those two times could actually be back-to-back. They could occur in subsequent years. So it's not as if we have one now and then it won't happen for another 499 years.
Yeah, but we've now had 8 500-year floods in 12 months, right?
Right. So, I mean, these events are certainly seemingly and anecdotally based on a researcher that I spoke with from the Weather Prediction Center happening more often. He called the frequency in the last 2 to 3 years remarkable.
So this might be the new normal.
It could be.
Coming up now. You have a story about emergency equipment, those automatic defibrillators we all see in public places?
That's right. So these are called AEDs, and these are potentially life-saving devices for somebody who has a cardiac arrest. And if you can get to one fast enough and use it to monitor the person's heart rhythms and potentially administer an electric shock, their chances of survival after that event or of lowering the damage that it would cause to their brain, for example, is much higher. So they have a better odds. So you see these all over the place in public places and in airports. But these researchers in Toronto took a look at how accessible they really are. So they monitored all the heart attacks that happened in Toronto for 8 years, and then they compared that to a record of AED locations throughout the city. And they found that actually only 1 in 5 of those people who had heart attacks was within easy distance or access to an AED. And of those AEDs that were within an easy distance, only maybe 80 or 70% of them were actually accessible. So the rest were behind locked doors, or the building was closed, or the facility wasn't open. And so it's sort of raising questions about how accessible these devices and useful they really are.
So what's the point of having the AED if you can't get to it?
Well, you could certainly make an argument that for those 1 in 5 people who did have one nearby, you know, that's an extremely valuable device to have access to. But you could also ask whether we could do a better job of making these more accessible.
And finally, there's a story, news about the self-checkout lanes.
Right. So I love these.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I do too. Yeah.
I use them whenever possible. But apparently some researchers in England took a look at, you know, what it means for retailers. Because when shoppers can just speed through, there, you know, might be more of a tendency to just, you know, skip checking that last item and just throw it in the bag. And what they found was actually stores that had implemented this, they audited 1 million shopping trips over the course of their study, and they found that the loss rate was about 4%. So retailers were losing about 4% of the revenue. That's about twice what you would expect with normal checkout lines. So either people can't figure out how to use the system, or they're potentially shoplifting more often.
Because, you know, there are people, I always see that there are supervisors hanging around to help you out, or maybe to keep track of what you're putting in the bag.
Right, that's true, but they don't really have an easy time of looking at everybody and monitoring exactly what you're doing. So there's a theory that the researchers who did this study came out with, and they were saying, you know, it might just be easier to shoplift in a way because you're able to make excuses, even if you are caught. So you're able to say, oh, I didn't realize, I didn't check that out. Oh, the system didn't work correctly, I wasn't sure how to use it. So there could be something psychological going on there.
I miscounted the amount of items in the bag.
Exactly.
I forgot to scan the last two.
Right.
I lost track. Fascinating. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Amy Nordrum, Associate Editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. And today we're going to talk about the medical marijuana. You know, it's legal in 25 states and D.C. But one area that's still lagging behind when it comes to medical marijuana is basic research. Government regulations have limited the science. But last week, the DEA announced a change to one roadblock. The agency will expand the number of institutions that can grow marijuana for research. My next guest is here to break down the good and the bad of the policy change for research. John Hudak is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington and author of the forthcoming book, Marijuana, A Short History. Welcome to Science Friday.
Ira, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. How many institutions can now currently grow marijuana for medical research?
Just one. There's a farm at the University of Mississippi, and they have the monopoly on the growth of research-grade marijuana.
Huh, that's not many, is it?
Not many, and it causes some problems for the research system.
And that's the good news or the bad news?
Well, right now, the monopoly is bad news. If you talk to researchers who do clinical experimentation with marijuana, looking for medical efficacy, they'll tell you that that monopoly creates roadblocks in terms of access, in terms of the speed with which they can get the product, and with the types of strains or potency or compositions of marijuana that they want to use in their research. The monopoly causes problems. Breaking that monopoly can only help.
Because I've read stories that the potency, for example, of the marijuana used in research is just a fraction of what's available to people on the streets.
Yeah, that's right. The medical marijuana that you would get from a dispensary in Colorado or in any of the half of the states now that have medical marijuana programs, you can have very low potency or a composition that has no psychoactive ingredients, all the way up to very high potency marijuana. And a lot of researchers want their research to reflect what's going on in America. And there's real limitations on that because of the supply from Ole Miss.
Mm-hmm. So what will the policy change do to make things better?
The policy change will mean that there will be some competition within this environment. That is, you'll have more people growing. That means that other institutions might be better at providing, in a sense, designer strains, meeting the needs of researchers, the relationship between THC and CBD, the psychoactive, main psychoactive ingredient in marijuana and the dominant non-psychoactive ingredient can be essentially mixed to researchers' needs. And you might have people out there, particularly there's a researcher at the University of Massachusetts who wants to do this, who might be able to meet those researchers' demands and, at the end of the day, improve the quality of research into these studies.
Well, you know, the legalization of marijuana is sort of a tsunami that's going through the states right now, even though it's still federally illegal. What's stopping the states themselves from carrying out their own research to see how it works?
Well, some states are encouraging research at the state level, and they're helping fund it. They're encouraging it publicly. But the challenge is that it doesn't meet that standard of federally approved research. And that means that in terms of publications and in terms of the medical community's embrace of that research, there can be limitations. There's still, at the end of the day, very few things that carry the gold standard weight of a federally approved medical research project. And as hard as the states try, they can't reach that status.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, John.
Thanks for having me.
John Hudak is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington and author of the forthcoming book, Marijuana, A Short History. We're going to take a break, and afterwards, we're going to look at the weird, wild world of Twitter bots. Those bots are writing poetry, they're helping activists, and much more. We'll talk about it after this short break. If you've never heard what a Twitter bot is, don't even know that you might be talking to one, we'll tell you all about them. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Support for this podcast comes from Harry's. Ever wonder why shaving is so expensive? Well, you know, it doesn't have to be. You can get a close, comfortable shave at a fraction of the price they charge you at the drugstore. Harry's has a shaving starter set for just $15. That price includes the razor, 3 blades, and your choice of Harry's shave cream or foaming shave gel. Here's how Harry's does it. You know, they bought a factory, a razor factory in Germany that has been crafting some of the world's highest quality blades for almost a century. And they ship the blades directly from that factory to you, cutting out the middleman and saving you money. And if you go to harrys.com right now and type in my code FRIDAY with your first purchase, they will give you an additional $5 off. That's HARRYS.com. And enter coupon code FRIDAY at checkout for $5 off the starter set. And start shaving smarter today. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Twitter is the home to hundreds of millions of users, but the company says that tens of millions of them, more than 23 million at last count in 2014, may actually be bots, not humans at all. These Twitter bots are automated pieces of computer code programmed to react to you and to other folks. Or they just sit there and tweet their code-generated content. Many of the original Twitter bots may have been designed to spam, to send out junk. But the bots have multiplied, and so have their missions. Many you see today are quirky, some are entertaining, and even artful. Here's what I mean. Take the bot called Botstan. This bot takes the song Gaston from Disney's Beauty and the Beast and creates new bizarre rhyming lyrics to the music.
No one phones like Gaston, pearl bites stones like Gaston, plans to liberate from down the nose like Gaston.
That's a bot called ThinkPiece. There's a bot called ThinkPieceBot that mashes up common headlines to create a tweet that might look like, is this big data to blame for swine flu? Well, is it? Another just tweets variations of the scream, ah! Variations of that on a regular basis. MuseumBot tweets photos from the Metropolitan Museum of Arts collection. Well, if it's not your cup of tea, you better get used to it, because the world of bots is not only weird, but wide and growing. We even made our own bot, and you can see some of the stuff it's tweeting at sciencefriday.com/Twitter, plus more bot examples on our website at sciencefriday.com/bots. They're all there, both of them. And what's fueling this craze? Let's find out. Darius Kazemi is a digital artist and programmer, founder of the annual Bot Summit Conference, and co-founder of the company FeelTrain. He's written dozens of bots for Twitter and other platforms. Kate Compton is a PhD candidate at the University of California, Santa Cruz. She's a bot writer and creator of one tool that helps non-programmers make their own bots. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, pleased to be here.
Glad to be here.
Nice to have both of you. Darius, besides writing bots, you've done a lot of work organizing the bot community, and you're sort of known as the bot dad and the bot father in bot writing circles. You have a summit that brings together bot makers. What's so great about bots, and what makes them great?
I like to think of it as keeping the internet weird. You know, I remember the internet from 10, 15, 20 years ago, and just how strange it was and how everything seemed like a new, unexpected thing to me. And I don't know, I think over time, you know, if things get more corporate and curated, and I like that bots just they throw unexpected things into your internet experience.
So what are some of your favorite bots that you've made?
That I've made.
Yeah.
I really like Two Headlines, which combines takes one headline for the news and then swaps out a different source for it. Subject for it. So for example, it might be like it might take a headline like Miley Cyrus to entertain millions at a concert, and then it would change that to Vladimir Putin to entertain millions at a concert.
Darius, our digital producer, Daniel Peterschmidt, made us our own Twitter bot. We named it sci-fry/ebooks. Our Twitter bot takes language from our old tweets and rehashes it into new, almost believable program ideas, like someday you may unlock your future phone with a grain of salt. this is a common approach to bots use, isn't it?
Yeah. It's specifically there's a whole genre of bot known as the ebooks bot, sort of named after a famous. It's hard to explain, but it was a bot that was not a bot in the end. It was called Horse Ebooks, and it was putting strange, amusing spam-like things. Basically, it turned out that it was a bot for a while, and then after a while, a human took it over, like a human poet, an artist, and started tweeting from it, and that's when it got really popular. And then people found out and felt betrayed that it was written by a person rather than a bot. But generally speaking, the ebooks bots, yeah, they're a whole genre. Like, I'm Tiny Subversions on Twitter, and I might have a Tiny Subversions ebooks bot, for example, that would take all my old tweets and jumble them up using a statistical method known as a Markov process, a Markov chain, and stitch them back together into kind of a word soup that is somewhat grammatically plausible, but not actually grammar most of the time.
Darius, you're one of the first. One of your first projects with the company was a Twitter bot called Stay Woke Bot, which was commissioned by the Black Lives Matter movement. What does Stay Woke Bot do?
Stay Woke is it's a collaboration with Deray McKesson and his crew of people with the movement for Black Lives, and What Stay Woke does is it's meant to sort of take some of the load that online activists have to deal with all the time. What DeRay was finding was that he was getting kind of inundated with the same sorts of questions and mm-hmm. sometimes harassment over and over. And so we designed this bot to help him kind of automate some of his responses to that. So he has a Google spreadsheet that he can just update with certain keywords and then have particular canned responses.
Kate, you write bots too. What are some of the ones you've made? Give us an idea.
Let's see. What have I made? Actually, just recently, 2 days ago, I made an Oblique Strategies bot. So there have already been Oblique Strategies bot because it turns out Oblique Strategies is a card game about introducing randomness into your creative practice. And so that's inspired a lot of bots that use randomness as part of their creative practice. So I made something called Art Idea Bot that gives you art ideas. I've made something that draws spaceships and then makes tiny little sci-fi stories next to them. And then I made something that just makes tartans all day long, different colors of tartans.
Well, that brings up the question, what are you both? Let me ask you, Kate, first. What gap in people's lives do bots fill the need? What need do they have that bots fill?
I like to think of them almost as a cuckoo clock, that it's a little decorative object that you have in your life, and you know that every hour or once a day or once a month, it's going to, I guess rather literally, tweet at you something new and bizarre and surprising. I think a lot of what makes bots so fun is that they have no filter. They're randomness. So much like Oblique Strategies, they sometimes put things together that you wouldn't expect them to put together. Or, for example, the Metropolitan Museum of Art bot tweets things from their collection, but it doesn't just tweet the good stuff. Sometimes it'll just be a shard of pottery or a scrap of fabric or a not very interesting vase. But for a moment, it takes this uninteresting thing and says, hey, look at this.
Yeah. Kate, do you think everybody can write a bot of their own?
Oh, absolutely. So the tool that was a collaboration between me and George Buckingham is called Cheap Bots Done Quick. And if you have a Twitter bot or if you have a Twitter account, you can log in there and make a bot in about 5 minutes. The challenge is really just thinking what you want to bot about. You can make something that wishes your mom happy birthday. You can make something that writes poetry. You can make something that makes art. You can make something that comes up with new Pokemon. Really, there's kind of no limit. In the same way that there's no limit to what you could write a poem or a short story about, you can bot about just about anything.
Darius, is there any way to know that if you're talking to a bot versus a real person on Twitter?
Well, yeah. The first thing, of course, is just to check the profile to see if it already self-identifies as a bot. Most of the bots that Kate and I have been talking about do identify as bots. It's actually really important for something that's like a work of automated art to sort of self-declare as a bot, because they do put together these strange combinations of things. And there was one bot creator whose bot accidentally put a death threat together and was ended up being visited by the police in, I believe it was in the Netherlands. And so declaring that something is a bot can be important for both aesthetic and practical reasons. But in terms of, this account just followed me on Twitter, can I tell if it's a bot or not? Typically what I do is I look at, especially if you're thinking about spam, look and see if there's a lot of other bots that are followed by it, or if it seems to have like not just look at one or two things that it's done, but look at its entire history and see if it's, somewhat human, or if you can start to see a pattern in it. That said, I've found actual people, live humans, whose Twitter accounts I was positive were bots.
Kate, do you think that bots are going to evolve to learn, for example, to talk to one another? I mean, we're going to have tens of millions of bots communicating?
A couple of them already do. I guess the big question is, how do bots listen? And a lot of bots, much like humans, will listen for when you stop talking and then will say what they wanted to say anyway. So the Endless Screaming bot that you mentioned earlier, which is one of my all-time favorite bots, I don't know why I love it so much, but I do, it will respond if you tweet at it. So I can say, Endless Screaming, how are you doing today? Ah, oh, that's great. How is that working out for you? Ah, so you can already communicate with bots and they'll just play the straight man kind of responding however they wanted. But then there's also bots that, I've seen this mostly with the art bots, that art bots will respond to each other. So there's the museum bot that tweets out museum works, but there's also an appreciation bot, which then responds to what the museum bot has posted with a little generative appreciation of it.
Hmm. Right, and I didn't build that for museum bot. That was another bot maker, Michael Cook, who put that together.
Hmm. So is it possible to make bots that could help you health-wise? Remind you maybe to take your medicine, remind you to go to the gym, things like that?
Let's see. I guess there's Nora Reed's, is it drink water? Hydration bot, I think.
Mm. Yeah, hydration bot.
That periodically reminds you to drink some water. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see when we get more people making these bots. A lot of these Twitter bots are kind of meant for large broadcasts. Like, I'm trying to tweet at everyone. Is there something that can just tweet at me if I'm the only person following my go for a walk bot, and it just reminds me to go for a walk, or it's time to feed your cat's cape? Yeah, there's no reason that all bots have to be for the entire world. Maybe they can just be for one person.
There was a great British bot called Bin Night, which is, you know, garbage night in the UK, and it just reminded you to take out the garbage on garbage night.
Well, I could use that one. And the bots are not limited just to Twitter, are they?
No, that's correct. They're I think a bot. In my experience, a bot can live anywhere that there's a technology for humans to talk to other humans. I mean, I think a robo-dialer that calls you with a survey on the phone is a bot. It's just a bot that's happening on the telephone system instead of on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. How exactly do they work? How complicated is the code? If you have, Kate, if you've gotten a tool that I can use, it's got to be not very complicated at all.
Sure. It's almost like, so there are many different approaches, and Darius has a lot of his own approaches. Mine is more like Mad Libs, where you give it a recipe for something you want to generate, and then you give it things that can slot into that recipe. So if you wanted to make mixed drinks, a little bot that makes mixed drinks recipes, you say a drink is made out of two liquids and a glass, and a liquid can be orange juice or soda or all these different things, and a glass can be a bucket or a copper mug or a tiki glass, and that'll be a bot. So it's really just kind of filling in the components of your world and telling it a recipe for how to combine them.
We've got a lot of folks interested in the bots. Let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato talking with Darius Kazemi and Kate Compton. A couple of tweets. I hope they're not bots that came in from Techno Terrorist says, God Tributes is one of the weirdest on Twitter. And maybe you've heard of that one. A lot of people are coming in. People saying that they love to have the bots, what percentage do you think are bots going to grow so that they take over a large percentage, if not already, of the tweets that are going out there?
Well, I mean, if you look at some of Twitter's SEC filings, buried in there was the admission that some very large percentage of Twitter accounts are bots. And part of that is because Twitter is somewhat lenient about bots. There are other platforms that try to shut down bots put a lot of effort into that. A lot of the future of bots and where it's going, where they go, depends on these platforms and whether they embrace the bots or not.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Kate, did you want
to? Oh, yeah, just... I have a fashion bot that I've been working on, trying to make the first ever bot-made fashion magazine, and I really wanted to have it on Instagram, but Instagram has a very strict no-bots policy, so Instagram is at least nominally bot-free at the moment.
Well, that raises a question of whether you have any kind of fear that these bots could run amok, out of control.
I mean, there's a limited amount of running amok that a purely software bot that can just tweet museum pictures and stuff can do, but I certainly put safeguards in a lot of my bots. I have a language filter that I apply to all of my bots it's basically, as a rule of thumb, it's words that I wouldn't say. I don't want my bots to say. They're not necessarily family friendly, but there are definitely some things like racial slurs and stuff that I just don't want the bots doing. And so I apply that uniformly across all of my bots. There's also just, you have to program these things. I think it's important to program these things so they don't annoy people or spam people, at least people who haven't signed up for it already. So I could make a bot that floods your feed with cat pictures every 30 seconds or something. But if I did that, I would make it be purely opt-in, like you would have to, you know, consent to getting that flood.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about your work on the online artist colony for bots.
Oh, yeah. This is very new, very novel work. It's still very much in production. But the idea is that I make these art bots. So this is with a collaborator, Jonathan Pagnetti. And we have a bot, or we have basically a bot art school that produces art bots. Each art bot has things that it likes and things that it's able to paint. And then these little art bots can communicate with each other. They can hate their own work. They can love somebody else's work. They can look at somebody else's work, wish that they could make that, take apart their work or the other bot's work and learn new ways to make red rectangles or yellow triangles or whatever it was that their personal little bot minds wanted to be able to make all along.
How does a bot look at someone's artwork?
It kind of goes back to the, like, how do bots listen or how do bots look? This is just a toy program for the moment. It's very new, and so we're just really looking at color. But we also have, there's an algorithm that detects cat pictures. We'll look at a JPEG, and we'll try to see if it's a cat or not. So we're hoping that one of our bots will really just wish that it could paint cat pictures all day, and we'll collect artwork that looks the most like it as cats.
Well, this is fascinating. I got to tell you, I didn't know very much about bots until we did this program today, but I've learned an awful lot, and I'm going to start looking for them myself. Oh, thank you both for taking time to be with us today, and good luck with your bots.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Darius Kazemi is a digital artist and programmer, a bot writer, and co-founder of FieldTrain. Kate Compton is a bot writer and computer science PhD candidate at UC Santa Cruz. We're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about chili science. Do you like chili peppers? Do you know all the different kinds of peppers? What makes peppers spicy? And I'm going to conduct a taste test. Well, we'll see how that turns out. Let's see if I can tell what pepper from another without getting too much in trouble. We'll be right back and try that after this break. Support for Science Friday comes from Blue Apron. I love their chicken piccata. And for less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make great home-cooked meals. And for August, Blue Apron is serving up meals like spiced pork burgers with goat cheese and cucumber corn salad, summer vegetable and quinoa bowl with fairy tale eggplants, shishito peppers, and corn, chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/science. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/science. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you know a chili head? These are people who can't get enough spice in their life. They might keep a little packet of chili flakes in their bag so they can dip into it in a pinch. And they're the ones smiling and sweating after a fiery meal. So what makes someone a spice addict and another person go running for the milk? Does that milk trick really work to extinguish the flames? Can you build up a tolerance for spice? All questions that we're going to ask and answer with our video producer, Luke Raskin, who's here to tell us all about a cascade of chemicals set off by those tiny peppers. It's the subject of our latest video. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
So when you bite a spicy pepper in your mouth, you feel a burning hot sensation, right? Is that the same type of reaction that happens when you drink a hot cup of coffee? Is it the same thing going on in your...
Well, yeah, for the most part it is. Both the heat and the active ingredient in a chili pepper, which is called capsaicin, it's a molecule, they both act on the exact same receptor, which is called a TRPV1 receptor. Most people call it TRPV1. And what happens is, you know, when you drink a hot cup of coffee or the capsaicin mm-hmm. binds to that receptor, the receptor opens up, ions flood in, those ions trigger the cell to become receptive. You have a signal that goes through the nervous pathway all the way to your brain that says, this is hot, this is hot.
and it's the exact same sensation. The difference here is that when you drink a really hot cup of coffee, you can actually destroy cells, you can burn yourself. But with capsaicin, it's not going to actually damage anything, unless you have it in really high concentrations, at which point you can damage a nerve.
You know, whenever you go out to people and you're eating hot food and you see people who are just chowing down on the chili peppers, they say, you've built up a tolerance to it over the years, right? Is that true?
Well, a couple things are more likely. If you've been eating really hot chili peppers your entire life, you may have possibly damaged your nerves, or you may be just inherently not as sensitive to capsaicin. So those are possibilities. But what's probably more likely is that you're just a little bit more masochistic than other people, and you've kind of learned to enjoy the heat more. You know, it does release endorphins in your brain. So maybe you're a little addicted to the endorphin release in your brain. It's very, you know, you're not going to suddenly have receptors that are less sensitive to capsaicin all of a sudden because you've just been exposing. That's not really how the receptors work.
The video that you just finished and put up on our website, you put our staff through it. Chili test.
Yes, I did.
And you put a trick in there, didn't you?
I sure did. So I gave people the choice of tasting the spicy sauce or the less spicy sauce. It was actually the same sauce. But beyond getting some really great reactions from the staff, which you can see in the video, people make some really interesting expressions when they have something really spicy. Everybody said they experienced roughly the same amount of heat. They all felt it in the same place in their mouth at roughly the same time. What they differed in was how they experienced it, whether they enjoyed it more. And the people that went for the more spicy sauce, those were the ones that clearly were enjoying the heat a lot more. And that's kind of backed up with research that's been done that showed that when people that are really spice heads or not spice heads have the exact same chili, they both perceive the same amount of heat. It's just the people that like the chili, the heat, they say they like it more.
Yeah. You know, after you've had something hot, people always tell you to drink milk, not water.
That's true.
Does that really work?
Absolutely. And better than milk is ice cream. Because,
oh, really?
Yeah. Well, so with ice cream, you get a cooling factor because it's ice cream. But inside of milk is two different things. You got fat and you got casein. And capsaicin, the molecule that causes the heat, has a long nonpolar tail on it. And when you have something like fat that you're eating, it can bind to the nonpolar tail. Or if you have casein, which is really into binding to hydrocarbons and nonpolar molecules, mm-hmm. then it will grab onto that as well. So ice cream or milk definitely works.
Finally, the last question to you is sometimes that, you know, the sensation can continue after you swallow. Can the peppers and the capsaicin hurt your intestinal lining?
Well, it can hurt you, the person, but you'd need really high concentrations in order to actually hurt your intestinal lining. What's going on is you've probably got a lot of inflammation. That can cause a little bit of damage, but it really, you know, the capsaicin itself is not going to damage you unless you have a ghost pepper or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not getting one of those.
Neither am I.
Not for your movie.
Neither am I.
Nobody's movie. Thank you very much. Luke Roskin, our Science Friday video producer, and you can watch that video where we subjected Sci-Fry office members to spice on our website. It's up there at sciencefriday.org/peppers, sciencefriday.com/peppers. With when your mouth is burning and your eyes are tearing up, it can be hard to appreciate the subtleties of a spicy pepper. How can the tingle of a jalapeno differ from the searing burn of a habanero? Well, hundreds of varieties of peppers are out there with their own heat profile, and my next guest says that the heat profile of a chili pepper is not unlike the complex flavors of wine. You know how complex that can be, and he's here to take us through a taste test and tell us how these different chili peppers get their heat. Paul Bosland is director of the Chili Pepper Institute and Regents Professor of Horticulture at New Mexico State University. That's in Las Cruces. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I'm almost afraid to ask this test I'm going to be taking with you. But when you go into the supermarket, you go in with a whole different attitude than most people about chili peppers. Because you know there are all different varieties of chili peppers, but I understand there are five main species, right?
Correct. There's Capsicum annuum, which is the most common one. That's the bell pepper, the jalapeno, serrano that you see. And then the Capsicum chinense, which is the habanero, becoming much more common. And that's what the ghost pepper is and some of the super hots. And then Capsicum frutescens, most people will only know this through Tabasco, like Tabasco hot sauce is made from that. And then there's two that people really don't know yet in the United States. And one is Capsicum baccatum, which is the chili from South America, sometimes called ají. And this is the Peruvian or Bolivian chili. So if you go to a Peruvian or Bolivian restaurant, you'd have those chilies seasoning the dish. And then the last one is called Capsicum pubescens or ricotto, lakoto. And it's very, very different and very, very rare to find in the supermarkets in the United States right now. But if you were in Peru and you were to get a stuffed pepper, it would probably be the ricotto. And a lot of people will eat that thinking it's a bell pepper. And then, boy, are they surprised when the heat kicks in.
Oh, I can imagine. I'm surprised that not being a chili eater and a chili expert like you are, that people can't really tell the difference between the different peppers there.
When you look at the what I've described as a heat profile, there's characteristics to chilies, and I tell people if you begin to become conscious of these characteristics, you will then know what chili's in the salsa or in the dish, and it really makes eating them a little more enjoyable. But I always want to kind of tell people that chili heat is like salt. You can always put too much salt in a dish and ruin it, and you can always make a dish too hot and ruin it.
Now, I know that you're a bit of a wild chili hunter. There are even more chili species out there that haven't been cultivated, correct?
Correct. We've only cultivate 5, and we know of at least 34 more out there in nature.
Could there be others we haven't discovered yet?
Yes, there are. People that study the taxonomy of chili say they think they've got 3 more kind of on the horizon that they'll be announcing that they've discovered.
And I've always heard that the seeds and the veins is where the real heat is located.
Now, that is a myth. It is the veins. It's the crosswall of the chili that has the heat. The seeds have no heat, but being very close to those crosswalls in the veins, one would associate that with the heat. But the walls of a chili are not hot, and we always have a little joke here. We take someone to our teaching garden where we have 150 different varieties of chilies, and I'll take a jalapeno and eat a piece of the wall and then give somebody the piece of the vein. Their mouth will get on fire. And I'll look like, I'm not bothering me a bit, but it's just a little breeder's joke, we say.
The joke's not on you, though.
That's right.
Let's go to the phones. Dale in Evanston, Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday. Hi, Dale. Dale, you there? Oh, we lost Dale. Well, let's go to Brooklyn. Hey, Joe in Brooklyn. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
My old hometown. Hi, welcome.
Hello. So I had a question kind of going back to the last person. When I eat hot peppers, I get the hiccups. But when I drink a hot cup of coffee, I don't. So I was just wondering how those two would be related, the receptors for the capsaicin and the hiccuping.
Paul, do you have an answer for that?
That's a common phenomenon with a lot of individuals getting the hiccups. And it's just a different kind of reaction. And sometimes I find that if people eat green jalapenos or green chili, they get the hiccups. But if they eat the red, they don't. So sometimes it's the type of chili.
Great answer. Let's go back to the phones. It's to Zach in Osage, Iowa. Hi, Zach.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I love hot foods, actually. So this whole segment's making my mouth water. And my question actually sort of goes back to developing a taste for chilies. When my mom was pregnant with me, she ate hot foods like it was her day job. And now I'm the person in my family who eats the hottest foods pretty regularly. And I was just curious if there's any science that sort of backs like a hereditary desire for spicy food, or if that's bogus, or what the deal could be there.
Your mom always loved him, huh? She still loves him?
She doesn't like the hot foods as much anymore, no.
Oh. Okay, Paul, what do you say?
As people age, we do change, and we know from science that our taste buds kind of become less sensitive, and so we don't taste as many flavors. And so usually as we get older, we do like hotter food because we want that little more spice. But everybody's genetically different, and in my career now, I've met 3 people that have no heat receptors in their mouth, and they can eat the hottest chili, and it tastes like a bell pepper to them.
Okay, now let's get to the part where I have to actually bite a couple of chili peppers here right in front of me. You have a taste test to help refine my heat palate. You're going to take me through this test here. I have a Serrano and a Thai bird's eye chili both here in front of me.
The first thing, don't take a big bite because we want you to be able to speak at the end of this. So take a little nibble. But what you're going to look for is first how fast the heat comes on. And with the Thai chili, it should be almost instantaneous. And then you're going to notice a very interesting thing about that heat is that the heat feels like pins sticking you.
All right. And then
it's going to be the tip of your tongue, and the heat should not last very long.
It's the tie. Whoa. Right at the tip
that
of my tongue.
That may not have been a small bite.
No, I just the juice coming out. I got to pour some milk here.
Okay.
I can see if that works, the milk part. Actually, it does. It does.
Pretty
okay,
good.
So why was
science
that?
Science has been proven.
Why was that such a searing, you know, sharp pain? And as you say, it's really concentrated in one part of my tongue.
Right. We know that there are at least 24 capsaicinoids, with capsaicin usually being the most prominent in the capsicum annuum. And so each one of those capsaicinoids has a different effect in our mouth when we consume chilies. And so by knowing, you know, which capsaicinoids are in which chili, you can then tell which chili you're eating. And so so one can assume, like with Asian chilies, you're going to have that sharp heat. And that was an interesting story. When I first came here, we tried to export red chili to Asia, and they told us we didn't have good quality. And we didn't understand what they meant because we could measure the color, it was good. We could measure the heat level and Scoville heat units and knew that. But they said you didn't have good quality. And then a few years later, we realized Asian chilies had this sharp heat. And so we looked at our chilies we were growing, found one that had the sharp heat, asked them to try it out. And they said, oh, yes, 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 that's very good. And so now we actually ship thousands of pounds of red chili powder to Korea to make kimchi, or Japan to spice up noodles.
Wow. All right, now I'm almost afraid to take the next one, but just so I can speak, while I can speak, let me remind you that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
All right,
talking with Paul Bosland here. I'm sorry, Paul.
I was just going to say on the Serrano, it's going to be a little slower, but the heat will be what we would consider rapid, but not as fast as the Asian.
And
this heat's going to be flat. It's going to feel like someone painted the heat in your mouth instead of pins sticking you. Again, it'll be the front of the mouth.
Oh, yeah. Ah.
And
it's sneaking up.
It's going to take a little longer to dissipate now. You're going to have that milk a little sooner than later.
Believe me, I'm going for it.
Because the heat there lingers. And one of the chilies that really has a lingering heat is habaneros. People will say, well, it's in the back of their throat, and it can actually linger for hours on some individuals.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there a rule of thumb? Are red chilies hotter than green chilies, or it doesn't matter?
You know, that's a very good question. And neither the color nor the size of the chili can you tell how hot it's going to be. As we mentioned earlier, you almost have to cut them open and see how much veins are on those cross walls. The more yellow you see in there, the hotter it'll be. And then also, the red chilies, if they come from the same plant as the green chili, will actually taste less hot to you, even though they have as much capsaicinoids, because the red fruits have sugars, and sugars is another way to counter the heat. So that natural sugar that's in the red pods counters the heat, so they don't taste quite as hot to us.
You know, I'm a gardener, always looking for gardening tips. Is there a way to make your backyard chilies hotter?
Yes, there is. Chilies get hotter if they're stressed. So if you will cut back on the water, make sure they're maybe in the full sun where they're getting stressed in the afternoons, they'll always be hotter. But the flip side of that coin is that you also have less yield when you stress a plant. So if you really want hot chilies, stress them and they'll be very, very hot. And if you don't, give them really optimum care.
You know, as a gardener, I'm trying to keep the squirrels out of my pots in the backyard from digging up the roots. So I planted some chilies right in the pot thinking, okay, squirrel came up to it, pulled off the chili, and as almost in spite, started chewing it right in front of my face with absolutely no problem. Is that the best you got?
I'm afraid, all I can say, it might be a Mexican squirrel, but no. We actually did a study here. We planted lettuce out in a field, and we put habanero powder on one set of lettuce plants and nothing on the other. And the rabbits would come in the nighttime, and they would, and within about, oh, 4 or 5 days, had eaten all the lettuce with no chili powder. But once they have eaten that, they went over and started to eat the lettuce plants that had the chili powder. So it's kind of a choice, no choice. So that's all I can tell you on that one.
That's enough. That explains it, Paul. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Paul Bosselin, director of the Chili Pepper Institute and Regents Professor of Horticulture at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. Have you heard of the Carolina Reaper, one of the hottest peppers out there? The inventor described its heat profile as a mouthful of molten lava. And you can read about it and learn lots more about chili peppers. It's on our spotlight page at sciencefriday.com/peppers. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer, Christopher Taliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, and Katie Heiler. Luke Raskin is our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Trying to talk after the hard to believe that Science Friday's first broadcast was 25 years ago. That's right, this is our silver anniversary, and to commemorate our amazing journey, we're hosting a gala event on October 15th at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum here in New York City. It'll be a celebration of everything we've done for the past 25 years with special guests like Alan Alda, Brian Greene, and more. And you are invited. So head over to sciencefriday.com/gala to find out more and to reserve your ticket. You don't want to miss this.